Hey there, fellow travelers. My name's Kai, and welcome to Misery Likes Company. I'm doing this episode a little earlier and with a little more wherewithal about me than yesterday's episode. Man, I was so out of it yesterday. That was, I was lightheaded and I was just kind of woozy. But like I said, these podcasts are for me first and foremost. So, you know, I do them every day, whether I want to or not, whether I'm feeling it or not. It is just sort of like exercise for me. And today I had to drop some stuff off at a buddy's house, and he brought up a topic that I was unfamiliar with, a term and a topic, and it got me thinking. And so today I want to talk about some of my favorite people in the world. And this, depending on who you spoke with, who you would speak with, this would be a controversial opinion. I've mentioned before, I don't have a problem with thieves in the same way that a lot of people do. So today I want to talk about con artists. I love con artists. I truly do. I have this thing. If somebody walks up and puts a gun in your face and robs you, I'm not a fan. I mean, granted, by my definition of ownership, whatever they took, they now own because they wanted it more than you did, because that's how things work. And if you have a problem with that definition, I point you to all geopolitical relations throughout all of history. That's just how shit works. March an army into a land and take it. And you didn't have as many people. You didn't have as much militaristic force. You didn't want it as badly. So it's just sort of a pragmatic definition of ownership that I've come to form over the years. But con artists are in a different category of thief. Con artists, by and large, don't steal from you per se. Con artists get you to give them something. And that's the beauty of it, is there is an art to it. There is actual skill. And I look, cat burglar, like how, cat burglars that manage to get in and out cleanly, and then, you know, then later you notice that you've been robbed. There's an art to that as well. But con artists are, it's terrible to even use it, but it's from the show Leverage. There's this scene where the thief and the con artist are having this interaction, and the thief, we have to find an entrance. And she's going with the con artist that night, and the con artist just chides her, tisk. Thieves find an entrance. Con artists make an entrance. And that's the difference. A thief ideally doesn't want to be noticed. A con artist doesn't mind if they're noticed, depending on what they're attempting to pull off. And so I have this appreciation. You spend enough time in Vegas, you get to meet a few. There's a very fine line, if none at all, between con artists and magicians. And if you're listening to this and you're a magician, you know what I'm talking about. The skill set that thieves, con artists, and magicians all use has so much overlap that it is a very nebulous area. And you can prove this just by showing that, one of the most famous tricks, it's a fundamental basic trick that everybody's seen a magician perform at some point in their life, and one of the best versions of this is done by Penn and Teller, is known by a set of tabula et calculi, cup and balls. The cup and balls trick has been performed for at least a couple thousand years. It may go way beyond that. There's a picture in Egypt it's on a burial chamber wall. That's something like 2500 BC, BCE. And so it could be, the cup and ball trick is probably the very first magic trick that took formation. And the cup and ball trick is the foundational platform for three-card money. And three-card money is nothing but a con game. It's there to steal your money in many ways. And so if you're not familiar, if you've never been taken by Three Card Monty or you've never seen it performed, I encourage, go watch. It's amazing. So one, in Three Card Monty, you can never guess the card. That's not how it works. The card is never where it's where you are directed to believe it to be. The card is being palmed and slipped and moved to various places depending on what the performer is attempting to do. And also, never when you walk up on someone when you walk up on somebody playing performing Three Card Monty in the street, there's more than just one person there. There's usually a minimum of three. You can pull it off with two, but the ideal situation involves three or more. Generally, the person you see put money down on the table, on the box, whatever, the first person you see put money down, they're in on it. They're part of the gang. They're seating the table. And so there's the guy running the table, running the cards, and the same principle, slipping balls under cups and palming the balls, stealing and palming the balls when just in fluid movements that your eyes just can't effectively track. All these sorts of techniques transition perfectly over to Three Card Monty. So there's the guy running the table. There's the guy who's usually seating the table. Clearly the Queen of Hearts is the third card from the left. Oh, it's done purposefully so you can see, and you're like, oh, it's that one. And the guy puts down $20 and he bets on the middle card. And you're like, this guy's a fucking idiot. He just lost $20. And, you know, he puts down another 20 on the first card, and now it's in the middle, and you're like, God damn it, I know it's in the middle. You're like, this is the part I really appreciate about con artists, is the psychological nature of it. It's not just this game running. One, they're showing you where the card is. You think you have one up. And this is the principle of Las Vegas. This is how casinos work. People who walk in there thinking they can be winners, they're the biggest losers of all. The casinos already know. They know how the game works. And casinos don't cheat, just so you know. That's not a thing. There is no rigged game anywhere in any major, real, legitimate casino in Las Vegas. You play a table game in somebody's room, you're going to get fucked. You're going to get ripped off. But you play a game in a casino. It's one of the most regulated, maintained, double-checked, triple-checked things in existence, honestly. But that's the art of conveying confidence into you, making you have a false sense of confidence. By hand two or three, the guy's looking at you going, hey, do you know where it is? Point to it. Point to it. You point to it, and, you know, the other guy looks kind of embarrassed. You know, he loses. And he's like, tell you what, point to the card. Ah, we got a winner here. We got a winner, you know. Oh, no. You got to put some money down. You know, only money plays. And you got a 10 on you? You got a 10 on you? And depending on who's running the game, they may drop some cash. Like, you put down a 10 and they put down a 10 and you pick the card and you win. And all of a sudden you're like, fuck, I can win at this game. I can make some money here. Hell yeah. Let me put down a 20. He puts down a 20. Yeah, you can win $40. Oh, you're a loser. Oh, you did. Oh, man, that's terrible. Give it another try. And now you're thinking to yourself, all right, shit, I'm down $10, but I won $10 before. Screw it. I'm going to put down another 10 or another 20. Now he's got you for 20 or 40. And this is just how this works. Now, remember, I mentioned that there is usually three people, if not more. So generally what you'll find is several people gathered around, and, you know, one, it is illegal, generally speaking, so you will find that they're constantly looking left and right and looking back and forth and, you know, that sort of thing. You're keeping an eye out. But what you're not paying attention to is they got you to touch your wallet. They got you to locate your money. There's somebody working the crowd, usually a pickpocket. A lot of times a female. women are generally given a pass by society. People don't think negative thoughts about the women around them. They don't look at a young attractive woman in their 20s, something like that, next to them. They don't think she's stealing from them. And in fact, you located your wallet for her. You took cash out of it. You're fucked. You're going to, you know, and then comes the final step is somebody will fucking yell, police, cops, popo, and everybody breaks. And you're just left standing there. And then you realize as you start to walk away that your wallet is missing. Yeah. Yeah. That's generally how Three Card Monty is actually run, is there's a gang that's running the game. And so you're getting worked from multiple angles. And, you know, it's a psychological element. It's a sleight of hand element. It's a misdirection element. All this sort of thing, these things come together. And these are techniques. These are tools of the trade that any magician is 100% familiar with. Any magician can run this scam. And they generally know, magicians generally know con artists. They know people who used to be con artists that are now magicians, or they, you know, work within the industry and they've had their fair share of gray hat experiences or black hat experiences. And so it's not just taking something. It's getting you to give it. Now, I mean, admittedly, on the back end, the pickpockets portion of that, that's, you know, okay, that's taking. But they got you to show. They got you to demonstrate where the money was. And so there is skill and art to it. And I always appreciate that, the sort of almost performance nature of con artists. And why don't we do a little history? Because, you know, I'm into this. I will get back to why this, my buddy and I were talking about and what spawned this entire thread, this entire narrative thread in my brain. But the original con artist was a guy by the name of William Thompson. He ran, it was, top of my head, it was like mid-1800s. He operated in New York City. He is the origin term for con artist, as near as we can tell from the historical record. Guy went by the name of, he went by numerous aliases, like any good con artist. But generally, it was Thompson, Thomas, or Samuel. All variations, William Thompson, Samuel Thomas, all sort of variations. This guy's name was William Thompson, but a lot of people knew him by Samuel Thompson or, you know, Samuel Williams, that sort of thing. He always, you know, sort of worked off of variations of his own name. His name was William Thompson. So first you have to know the origin of the term mark. Everybody knows that. He's a mark, you know, that's the thief, you know, there's the mark, there's the guy they steal from. The origin of the term mark comes from most likely pickpocket and stick-up gangs, but more pickpockets, but it later, you know, had other connotations. But early on, dirt or chalk. And so the spotter would keep their eye out for a valuable, somebody with valuables on them or somebody who's demonstrated or displayed wealth or money in some form or fashion. You know, keep an eye on the ticket booth at the train station and see who's got a fat roll or who's got a lovely pocket watch or wallet. And, you know, what they'll do is they'll just brush by them. And what they're actually doing is human kinesthetics are interesting. I can generally touch you on the shoulder if I bump into you. If I just bump into you, I can touch you on the shoulder and you won't notice the touch to the shoulder. You'll just notice me kind of generally bump into you. And that's what they would do is they, you know, walk by and just, oh, sorry. And what they do is they brush your shoulder on the back. Generally not the top, but the back. And a little bit of chalk or dirt. There's the mark. That's the origin of the term mark, is you are literally marked for the gang so they could see who to steal from. And then, you know, they don't have to have communications. This goes back hundreds of years. They don't require active communication. Then the rest of the gang can just keep an eye on the lobby or the train and see whoever has the mark, and they know I, you know, steal from them. And so William Thompson would just cruise the streets looking for upper class marks. It's easy to see. Con artists are educated in things that a lot of us aren't educated in. They can read watches, and I don't mean the time. I mean glance at somebody's wristwatch and tell you probably approximately how much they earn based on the quality of the watch. That sort of thing. Knowing being able to notice a finely tailored suit or the cut of the cloth or that, oh, that's, you know, that sort of material, that silk. Okay. You know, they can analyze you and tell whether you have money or not. And so he'd approach upper class marks and he would pretend to know them. Just start a conversation up, and generally, if anybody has interactions on this level, you know, business interactions, high wealth individuals, this sort of thing, they are generally educated or savvy enough to not, they don't want to insult anyone. And so, you know, I mean, this guy, who knows who he is? So, you know, oh, of course, you know, oh, it's been years, that sort of thing. He'd have a conversation with him. He'd, you know, start the ball rolling. And the man, you know, well-spoken, well-dressed. He's acting like he knows you. And so this gains trust. This ingratiates him into your psyche to some extent. Now, this is where it gets insane. And the average person is just left behind. And it's that sort of trick that any good salesman will tell you, it will inform you that this is a possibility, that you can just ask people questions and they'll say yes to questions that they shouldn't say yes to. I mean, this is how you make sales in some instances. He'd ask them to lend him their watch. It's that simple. He'd say something like, "Do you have the confidence in me to lend me your watch until tomorrow?" Now, this is weird, given societal and cultural norms, especially in America today, for someone to walk up to you and say, you know, "Hey, do you have the confidence in me to lend me whatever?" And you're not even certain if you know them, but we're talking a different era, a different time, a different culture. And so he walked up to this guy one day. And I just know this sort of stuff. This is stuff I've studied before. I don't have the notes. He walked up to this guy and asked him whether he had the confidence to lend him his watch until tomorrow. And the guy said, sure. It was a watch valued at $110. Now, you're like, okay, so most people would say, you know, I'm not lending anybody $110. But you got to remember the type of person he was gunning for. He wasn't gunning for you or I. He wasn't gunning for a peasant. A $110 watch in 1840 was around $3,600. So this dude had the balls to just walk up to random rich people and be like, "Hey, can you loan me $3,600 till tomorrow?" This dude did. Gave him the watch. It's insane, but it's true. The only reason he got caught, the only reason we know this story, is he happened to bump into the guy. Just shit luck. He ran into one of his marks. He ran into one of his victims. And, he immediately got turned in. There was some officer nearby, and he tried to get away, but they ended up taking him in. And he ended up in Sing Sing for a little bit. But this is the origin of the term confidence artist or con artist. Is confidence, con artist comes from confidence. The con and con artist comes from confidence, and confidence is from confidence man. And it's from this one dude by the name of William Thompson who would walk up to people and say, "Do you have the confidence in me to lend me your watch until tomorrow?" And people would. And he'd just not return them because duh. And so this is where con artists actually come from. And there's all sorts of great ones. There's ones that were really skilled at it. There were ones that, you know, I've mentioned before, Victor Lustig. Victor Lustig is one of the goddamn kings of con artists. This man, he sold the Eiffel Tower twice. For real. One day I will break that down moment by moment, but let's go into it. I don't have any of the dates. I can do a rough outline. One day I'll get into the specifics. Victor Lustig was a con artist in France, and he put out an advertisement. He put out word that you have to remember the Eiffel Tower was not what it is today. It was put up as a demonstration. It was put up as a temporary display. It was not expected to be a national monument. It was not expected to be what it is. And so he put the word on the street that the government was auctioning it off for scrap. Gets a group of, I forget, it's like 6 or 8 contractors, and, you know, shows them the Eiffel Tower, tells them that, you know, yeah, we're scrapping it, and, you know, we'll hold a bid, and highest bidder can just tear the fucking thing down, and the steel is yours to do what you will. You know, sell it, scrap it, melt it down, it's yours. There's lots of raw material there. And Victor, the wife of one of the contractors, one of the bidders, became suspicious because Victor was looking for cash. He was looking to turn this deal fairly quickly. And so it smacked of a sketchy deal. But there's an old con artist's sort of saying, idiom, that you can't con an honest person. And you can, by the way, you can. But the intent behind that statement is, in fact, greed is the number one thing that you take advantage of as a con artist. That's it. If you can get somebody's greed activated, generally you can get them to go along with whatever sketchy scam you're trying to run on them. And so he was utilizing their greed. He was trying to, you know, use basic profit incentive to get these fuckers to bid. And he, you know, highest bidder, it's cash and, you know, that sort of thing. And this dude's wife pulled him aside, like called him out and said, you know, there's something sketchy going on here. I don't trust you. What are you up to? And he confessed to being a government official who's looking to scam some money off the top of this deal. And that was the grift. And so she bought it. So not only did he get the bid, her husband, by the way, was the highest bidder. Not only did he get the auction prize, she threw in a little extra bribe to make sure that they were the ones who won the auction. They delivered the cash, a suitcase full of cash, to him at the Paris train station, and he left. Yeah. What do you think happened to Victor, to his victim, to the legal ramifications? Nothing. Nothing happened. That's what happened. They were too embarrassed. Again, psychology. They were too embarrassed to actually do anything about it. So what do you think Victor did? Victor just sort of did a lap and came right back and ran the scam again. This time, the guy he ran the scam on successfully got suspicious and overcame his ego and reported it to the police. Victor, of course, escaped. He ended up taking a ship across the Atlantic at one point, and he ran black money. Long and short of it, there's a scam called black money. I hate anybody who falls for black money. I truly, you know, you're not supposed to blame the victim. Victims of black money scam, I have negative sympathy for. I really don't like people who fall for the black money scam because it's so obvious. It's so painfully obvious. The gimmick is essentially, I've got a thing here. I got a bucket full of money that I managed to retrieve. When the government destroys money, they dye it all black, or they black out the money, and then they destroy it. And I've got a guy who's in charge of the transport, and he threw me a pallet of the money off the back of the truck, and nobody will notice it's missing. See here, blah, blah, blah. And I've got this formula or this machine that will get rid of the black, and you can, you know, you just strip it out. So you buy from me the chemicals, and here, I'll do a demonstration. Of course, course it's a seated demonstration. Of course there's this, there's one or two bills that have been saturated in some sort of solution that can be desaturated, that can be effectively bleached or removed, or using a reagent, just turn its color. And, you know, oh, wow. And yeah, here, just, you know, buy these jugs of overpriced soap water or whatever the fuck, just water. Soap would cost too much. Just buy these jugs of water and you can have the money for free or whatever. And that's the black money scam. And, I mean, think about it. If I had a bathtub full of cash and I had the chemicals necessary to launder it into workable cash, why the fuck would I involve you? And it always involves this sort of, you know, quick-witted, silver-tongued spiel about how you don't have time, or, you know, that's why he was doing it on the trip over. It was, oh, no, he didn't run. He ran a variant of black money on the trip over. It was the money printing device. It's a variant, but it's, you know, essentially it's a device. It's a box loaded with a couple of bills, valid bills, and it just slowly unfurls these bills. You know, just a simple spring and gear mechanism, and it just slowly pushes them out. And, you know, I have this thing that prints money, but it's too slow for me. So why don't you take it off my hands for X amount? And, you know, as soon as the second bill pops out, it's done. There's nothing, it doesn't print money. It just shoots out money that's been put in it. And so it's a variant of the black money scam. So Victor ran that on the trip over the Atlantic. He ended up getting busted by the I want to say the FBI in America, because his girlfriend, keep in mind he was married, his girlfriend turned him in, and he escaped while in custody. The guy was fucking amazing. That's, you know, Victor Lustig is one of the big ones. Lou Blonger is sort of a what more people think of as like a quote-unquote classic con man. The average person amongst magicians and con men, Lou Blonger isn't really anything to write home about, but he sort of is what most people think of as like a con artist. He was born in Vermont back in, again, the mid-1800s. The 1800s were essentially the golden age. Like 1820 to 1920 was basically the golden age of con men, of con artistry. Lou was born, Blonger, by the way, Blonger, if memory serves. He was born in Vermont. He was one of, he ran one of the longest running confidence rings in the American Old West. He, I forget how old he was, but he was like a teenager when the Civil War broke out, and he enlisted in the Union Army and ended up playing a fife. He was a fifer. He was too young to fight. So that's what they did with those boys. You know, here's an instrument. But after the war was done, he survived. He and his older brother, I don't remember his older brother's name. Sam. His older brother's name was Sam. He and his older brother moved out west. They were gonna, you know, make their riches. They were gonna gain their riches in the old west. Well, old for us, and the west for them. So for a couple of decades, basically, they worked the saloons and the mines, a little bit of gambling, a little bit of prospecting, you know, some con games. Reportedly, not a whole lot of hard evidence, but, you know, they ran into the likes of, you know, Masterson and Earp and Doc Holliday and that sort of, all those kind of crew. But by the late 1800s, they settled in Denver. So anybody in Colorado, you guys probably know these names already. they settled in Denver. They ran a saloon in Denver, and they became very wealthy. They made investments in mining claims, and they made profit from the saloons, gamblers, but they also provided whores. They provided prostitutes. Painted ladies was their favorite term for it. So, con games, saloons, gambling, sketchy mining investments and prostitution. They were your general gang. I mean, that's what they were running. But they ran a lot of con artist style games. One of their largest that they were known for, if you've ever seen the movie The Sting, you'll be familiar with this sort of setup. They set up a fake betting house. Betting windows, chalkboards, ticker tape machines, the whole nine yards. And they'd convince customers to put up huge amounts, I mean, especially for the day, but huge amounts of money to secure profits in some form or fashion, or winning bets on horse races that weren't really happening. So, yeah, if you've ever seen The Sting, that's what they were running. That's the inspiration. And so they had, of course, you know, they were running shell games and they had pickpockets in the building. And so it was an all-in-one sort of Walmart superstore of just con artistry and small-time grift, but done to a huge scale. And so they ran that city for quite a while. They were basically the mob in Denver for couple decades, basically. They had a good run, like 1880 to 1900 sort of territory that they were just banging it out. And he ended up getting in bed with a guy, Kid Duff. He became Blonger's second in command. Dude was experienced, opium, pickpocketing, gambling. I mean, the dude, that's when they sort of transitioned to full-on organized crime. And by that point, it was in. The fix was in. Blonger could get you off from any charge. You know, he had the contacts. But it ended up, a cop ended up basically going around all of the criminally corrupt Denver politicians, and he established a secret police force essentially to bust these guys. And they ended up, by the time that they were actually convicted, by the time that Blonger was actually convicted of anything, he only got sentenced to like 5 or 10 years, but he died in jail. The dude was 70 something. 72, 74, something like that. So he died in prison. And Duff got out. Duff managed to get out. No. I'm sorry. Kid Duff committed suicide. He was not going to go out like that. So Lou died in prison at like 70 something. Kid committed suicide, and Sam, his older brother, if you remember, because he was in on it as well, he had died like a decade or something earlier than that. So we have, you know, Lou isn't really one of the most clever con artists that ever ran, but he sort of gave form and shape to what would be, you know, confidence rings and that sort of thing, and really laid the groundwork for modern organized crime, and started as, you know, just a con artist. It's like, yeah, you know, I'll scam some games, I'll run some, you know, some false table games, and then, you know, moves up to full fake betting houses and shit like that. And so this brings me to what we were, I'll stop talking about the history of con artistry. And my buddy brings up, he's got a huge Discord server with a lot of fucking people involved. Brings up e-whoring. Electronic whoring, but e-whoring. It's a thing that quote-unquote hackers are doing. And again, coming from an IT background, I hate the misuse of the word hacker. I consider that a protected, sacred word. And For me, I use the old school MIT inspired version of what hacking is. Hacking is nothing more than someone who understands something so intricately, so to such a detailed level that they can manipulate it. Traditionally, it was used for systems administrators who understand the hardware, the software, the networking. They understand the user end of interfacing with these systems. They understand as much as they possibly can about the entirety of the system in totality. And so they can manipulate it. They can exploit it. They can break it. And that's a hacker. And unfortunately, hacker has just been pissed on as a word. But basically, e-whoring is convincing... How do I want to describe this? E-whoring is convincing a mark to give money to or follow affiliate links or buy goods or services in some way, shape, or form from traditionally women online with risque or naked photos. Now, where the con portion of this actually comes in is that these are just dudes. This is, you know, it's a fat Ukrainian dude sitting there in his fucking, you know, wife beater t-shirt. And you can get the pictures by crawling and by spidering websites. You can, you know, Tumblr before they went no porn, but basically you can set up electronic methods to spider entire segments of the internet and use crawlers to... These days, you can use a machine learning algorithm to actually parse out the photos that are suspected nudity, and you can utilize these in your scam. But having looked into this, as soon as he mentioned it, cause, you know, I know he knows that this is the sort of thing that would interest me. I immediately started looking into it, and one dude paid a model. Decent money, paid a model, but he had very specific needs for the photo shoot. He wanted a whole detail, not the photos that most people, like when you think porn, that's not what he was after. He was after basically every sort of situation that someone could ask for. He needed her on the couch. He needed her in the bathroom. He needed her in front of a mirror. He needed her holding up a piece of paper so he could Photoshop the paper later with verification details that people would ask for. Hey, write this on a piece of paper for me, and that sort of thing. So he had all these sorts of... He had experienced and learned from running this con that, you know, certain people would ask for certain things. And now he, you know, used his earnings to hire a model to pose naked for him. And he ended up getting hundreds of photos out of this one model. And, you know, and so now when anybody asks for, you know, oh, if it's really you, do this. And he's got something akin to that. And, you know, oh, write this on the paper. And he just, you know, slaps it into Photoshop, quick template, no problem. And so there's people making hundreds of dollars a day e-whoring, just convincing people to, and multiple methods. So it's not just... Okay, so basically the bare bones version of this is find a method for people to come across your photos. Blog, social media, Tinder, it doesn't matter. Find a way to hook dudes. Thirsty, horny, pathetic dudes. Find a way to hook them. And then when they start getting all creepy on you and they start, hey, why don't you send me a... You know, well, I'd love to, but I've got rent to pay and that sort of thing. I guess, if a really good con artist, they don't even mention the money. I'd imagine that a really good high art version of this is the money is never even mentioned. It's just, you know, you dangle the possibility of those nudes out there and you let the self-selection filter go to work. The guys that are willing to pay will mention they're willing to pay, and you've got them. And I'm like, well, I suppose I could take a new, you know, I could, well, if you're willing to, I could really use oh my God. And you throw them the sob story and you throw them the whatever. And, you know, if the guy's doubting you, you throw him the verification pick. And next thing you know, he throws you 20, 30, 50, 100, 300, 500 bucks. I mean, depending on what you're actually doing, you know, who you're gaming and whatnot. But there's also automated methods of this that you can set up, like affiliate links for adult websites and, you know, product sites. And, well, if you buy, you know, I sell these and that sort of thing. And you can actually derive passive income from thirsty dudes from stolen photos. Because that's the thing, is most people don't go to the lengths. The guy I mentioned actually hiring a model. Most people just, from what I've seen, most people go online and buy eHorror packs. And it's a pack of like 300 or 500 photos that have been collated and specifically pulled off the internet and collated into groupings that are most useful for this sort of scam. And he had become familiar with it by way of, and I'm going to try and get the guy. I'm going to try and get him on. Maybe he'll be my first guest ever. He's got a guy on his Discord who does this, this guy does a few things. He's got a few sketchy side businesses, and this is one of them. And I don't know the actual, I mean, I don't know what the legality of this would be, depending. I mean, it would vary from region to region, state, country, that sort of thing. I imagine that if you were running this out of Romania or something, it's probably not illegal at all. No offense, Romania. It's just, you know, if you're familiar with organized criminal elements in Europe, you realize that a lot of, you know, Romania's got a solid segment. A lot of Romanian pickpockets in England. They're really good at it. But dude is, yeah, he's got some guy on his Discord server who one of his side gigs is an e-whoring scam. And apparently he makes, you know, decent money. He's not going to buy a yacht off it. But when you're scraping by as one of the peasantry anyway, this is one of the hustles. And, you know, he mentions this to me and immediately go looking. And, you know, he's like, hackers are doing it. And that immediately annoys me. So I have to go look, you know, what's going on? How is it? You know, what is this? And it's not really hackers, but there are IT people involved because, they set up automated scrapers. They set up machine learning algorithms to find this sort of material for use. And there's e-whoring guides, there's packs, there's methods to drive traffic, there's all sorts of shit that you can get from sketchy, nebulous websites that, you know, don't give them your credit card, but if you throw, you know, you want to throw them a chunk of Bitcoin or something like that, you may find something. But there's a lot of black market forums that are running this sort of deal. And like, you can find packs that guys have commercialized. I'm betting if you set up your own scraper and you go to the trouble of collating and packing this stuff, then what you sell that to people trying to run the scam, you could probably make even more money. I don't know the average going cost, but I pulled up a couple of examples of packs that were going around and being sold and that sort of thing. And they are all, they're sort of amateur style videos and photos, nothing too professional, because that's the idea. It's supposed to be just someone who, it's just some girl off the internet. And like, dirty mirror kind of photo sort of thing. And like, the pack will have 74 pictures and 3 videos and 6 verification photos. And so there's an entire industry happening here of mild con artistry. I mean, not much artistry to it per se, but a lot of conning. And I just, I was fascinated. I'm always fascinated by the newest con and, electronic techniques for con artistry. And yeah, I was, I was pleasantly, I was right chuffed by learning that there's this new one. And yeah, e-whoring. Dudes making money, conning other thirsty dudes with pictures they find online of naive chicks that put too many photos out there, and taken in their entirety, they can be repackaged and used to make a decent amount of money. From what I've seen, I mean, some of the earnings that have been mentioned in some of the forums that I'm aware of, and because, you know, like I said, I'm a fan of con artists, so I troll some forums that are known for shoplifting and thievery and con artistry and black market stuff, and they some of these guys they're making $200 to $500 per day passive. And I mean, you think about that, you know, you take that on the low end, and you know, I mean, that's $6,000-ish a month extra income that you can, I mean, if you're okay with doing this sort of thing, chances are you take that $6,000 and you turn it, you know, you just reinvest it and you turn it into something else, whether it's, you know, buying coke off the dark web and stepping on the coke and reselling that locally, or whatever your, you know, whatever your other hustles are. But, you know, an extra $6,000 to $12,000 a month, that can't hurt anyone. I mean, that's, you know, shit, that's decent money. Everybody, you know, shit, if I offered you an extra $6,000 a month, chances are you'd take it, wouldn't you? Exactly. So that's e-whoring. I hope you learned something. I hope that, you know, I hope that from this you realize that not every con artist is a terrible human being. Most of the time, con artists are just people who don't want to work within the system and see the scams that are being run from on high and say, fuck it, I'm going to run my own scam. And they do. And, you know, if the government, if a major corporation, you know, runs these sorts of scams, then they're just allowed to. But if you and I run them, then it's a crime. So that's, you know, that's sort of how I look at it. Well, I hope, as always, that you're as well as you can be. And if you want to find me, if you want to have a conversation, you can find my website at themlcpodcast.com. My name's Kai, and this has been Misery Likes Company.